What was it that got you to that point where you became a real voice out there in the in what's going on in the country?
I got rich as fuck, so I didn't have to care what anybody thought.
You know, I should have done that.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night, and good luck.
Hey, folks, it's Rick Wilson. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project podcast. I am delighted to be joined today by a very special guest. It is Mark Cuban. You know Mark from a million different things. Tech entrepreneur, Mavs owner, Shark Tank. And recently, he's become, I think, one of the most important political voices in the country by being a kind of non-political guy. He's also tackled some of the hardest problems out there with a really incredible new company called Cost Plus Drugs, which is trying to take on one of these problems that everybody says is impossible, which is to bring down the price of pharmaceutical products for folks. So Mark is a really smart guy and a really down-to-earth guy at the same time. And Mark, I appreciate you coming on the show today. And I want to ask you, I want to jump right in here.
Sure.
You've become a really clear voice in our politics, and not in the same normal, like, left-right categories, but like a really voice of common sense and decency lately. What was it that got you to that point where you became a real voice out there in what's going on in the country?
I got rich as fuck, so I didn't have to care what anybody thought.
You know, I should have done that.
I mean, I hate to be that crass about it, but, you know, when you're on your way up, which I was for so many years, you know, starting from the bottom, now we're here, it's just like, you have to pay attention to everything around you. You have to be cognizant of what could turn your business or your financial life upside down. And for the longest time, I never paid attention to politics. And then when Trump ran the first time, I got involved some with Hillary and learned a few lessons. And then, you know, as things progressed through the Biden administration, learned a few lessons. And through the Harris campaign, learned a lot of lessons. And it was just like, look, it's at some point, since I'm an independent, I don't have to kiss anybody's ass. And, you know, I'm focused on doing something I think is very beneficial, which is Cost Plus Drugs and changing healthcare and trying to save lives and save money. And I try not to take any of this for granted. And I just think I could have an impact. And I don't give money to politicians, as you know. And so I don't want it to be about, okay, I gave you money, listen to me. It's either my ideas hold up and you think there's value in them or they don't. And if they don't, that's fine too. So I really don't have to, you know, play a role at all. I just, you know, do what I think is right, say what I think is right, and go
so
from there.
You came out of the first big wave in the tech industry. You did broadcast.com way back in the 90s. You were the earliest of early adopters in this sort of business. The new model strikes me as it has attracted fewer guys from the kind of backgrounds that I think we come from, you know, more regular folks who more middle, upper middle class kids. And it's gotten to this, like, it's become this very weird culture in Silicon Valley that has strange ideas about politics. And Musk is really affecting that, I think, at the national level of inserting some of this, the oddball nature of Silicon Valley into the White House, into the politics and what they're doing with Doge, all that. How has that culture that you experience changed? Because it strikes me as it's almost like an alien country now.
No, it's not so much that it's changed, honestly. So when you talk to young kids who are trying to start companies in Silicon Valley, the cultures today and, you know, 25 years ago were very similar. You know, that's very entrepreneurial. Right. They're trying to come up with ideas. You know, we started streaming. Now they're building things around AI. That's very similar. It's really the people who have made a lot of money who are trying to who are asking themselves, what can I do to have an impact? What can I do to change things? Or what's the next level I can go to personally, financially, impactfully in terms of my company or politically? And so I think, you know, you get you've got a set of circumstances right now where AI is going to be a multi-trillion dollar business. And you've got, you know, these five, six, seven players that realize that it may be a zero-sum game. I don't think so. They don't think so, but they realize it's a greater than zero chance. It'll be, you know, one big winner take all.
Sure.
And they all want to be that winner. And they will do whatever it takes to be on top with that outcome. So if that means writing Donald Trump a big check and kissing the ring, I mean, it makes perfect sense. Because all it takes is one swipe of the pen in an executive order and, you know, they're out of the running. And so I think that's part one. And then you've got the Mark Andreessens of the world,
Yarvin,
and the Curtis, you know, that have this the Garvins that have this philosophical thing where they think they have a better way, which is just entrepreneurial in its own right. It's kind of crazy the point they've gotten to, in my opinion. But, you know, so it's just that those are the older statesmen that have made a lot of money, who want to win AI, and who think that they can, that they're smarter than the politicians and can push them where they need to go.
That idea that, you know, Musk was going to come in and cut the size of government down. I mean, almost no one says, wakes up in the morning and goes, we need a much bigger government. But I think a lot of people think we need a smaller and smarter and better government that is driven by some entrepreneurial principles. But what they're doing right now seems to me like this slash and burn, like cut it all and see what grows back. I'm not sure that's the best way to do it. As you've been a serial entrepreneur, you've seen over and over again, you have to curate a company. You have to grow it into something to make it effective and to make it work. What are the lessons that you would have brought into this thing if President Harris had said to you, hey, Mark, help me reinvent government? What would you have been doing?
Well, let's look at it like if they fired Elon and brought me in, what would I do, right? Because here, where we are today. So trying to cut the size of government, even when I was out campaigning for Harris, like I talked to her specifically, we have to make government smaller. We have to deal with the deficit. And so then you say, well, how do you get there? And cutting a lot of people, for better or worse, comes with the territory. You can't make government smaller and not cut hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, who knows, some significant number. And then there's, you know, when you cut those people, there's the infrastructure that's going to go with it. But the question you want to ask is, what's the best way to do it? And what they've done is ready, fire, aim. So if I walked in the door, there's two things you have to do. You have to have a plan, because shock and awe is great. But if there's no plan behind shock and awe, it's just shock and awful, not shock and awe,
right.
And so, you know, and so putting together a plan and communicating that plan and doing it in a staggered manner so there's not, you know, the chaos and the economic uncertainty. So for instance, the challenge that they have right now that they've got to inherently realize, because they're not dumb, is when you do all these things at once, the second order economic impacts are significant in a lot of different towns, cities, states. So when you cut, you know, like they're cutting the forestry service, and a lot of those people live in small towns in the state of Washington or the state of Oregon. And now all of a sudden, those towns, their economies are decimated. You know, when you say you're going to cut all these grants from all these colleges, now all of a sudden they need to fire people. They need to, you know, cut way back. Then you have the contractors that work in D.C. that, you know, whatever it is that they're contracted for, now their contracts are gone, right, or reduced significantly. So they have to cut back on people. All these things, when they're aggregated together in one town and or across, you know, cities or in cities, that has a significant economic impact. Then you have the uncertainty of the tariffs. It's not so much that tariffs are bad. It's just that how you implement the tariffs and where, and whether it's strategic or across the board, makes a huge difference. But when you have this tariff uncertainty on top of all the firings that look like they're going to be firings, on top of all the cutbacks on the grants, on top of all the NIH academic research cuts, you know, and then on top of that, you've got the contractors who no longer have contracts and they have to fire people or they go out of business, all those things add up into a lot of money that have a significant amount of impact. You know, the cost of tariffs just is not just the cost of the tariff. There is a cost beyond the cost of the tariff. And I'll give you one perfect example.
Okay.
One of my Shark Tank companies is just crushing it. And there's growing their sales, they're growing everything, but their product is one that they can't just raise their price. There's just not the pricing elasticity that other products may have. And so knowing they can't raise their price, they have to cut back cost elsewhere in order to be able to take the margin that they're going to lose, whether it's a 10, 15, 20, 25% tariffs. And one of the things that they did was cancel a $2 million conference for all the people, you know, all their stakeholders in the state of Florida.
I think you really got to it, though, that there's the second order effect and the ripple effects that happen from these things. It's like a classic unintended consequence in economics, where you think I'm going to take this one step, but that step actually ends up with having five or six other steps you're not following along, and it ends up because look, I think when the next jobs report comes out, it's going to blow a huge hole in the next jobs report, and you know.
I don't know if it's the next
true.
One.
Yeah, like yeah.
We saw, you know, it's hard to predict exactly when. But like we saw the stuff that just came out for February, and you know, there were a lot of people. It wasn't so bad. You know, inflation was down a tenth, right? A lot of that was because companies bought more inventory so that they wouldn't have to raise their price. You know, but what you're seeing is other companies who are taking advantage of the tariffs. You know, it's the old dishwasher thing during Trump one, right, where he put tariffs on dishwashers, and despite the fact that he took them off, the price of dishwashers went up, right? And you'll see the same thing happening here. Companies will raise where the companies have pricing elasticity, they will raise their prices for one reason.
And they'll say, it's the tariffs, but even if it's not any longer the tariffs. I mean, you heard a million pitches on Shark Tank from folks, and supply chains globally, almost everybody relies on a pretty complex global supply chain that needs to have the least amount of friction that it can for people to make a profit. And I worry about the combination of the tariff war stuff and the shaky international position we're finding ourselves in now, that the global supply chain is much more fragile than people think when you get it pressured from two separate sides.
I don't know necessarily that it's more fragile, because the countries that were facing tariffs aren't dumb either, right? They went and created alternatives, and you know, China opened companies in Mexico and in Canada. You know, even you know, here's the biggest thing that's crazy that most of your podcast listeners probably don't get. So, the relationship between China and selling on Amazon, and the relationship between Chinese companies and Amazon, it is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And it's the ultimate, you know, you talk about hacks, you know, day-to-day hacks, the ultimate business hack for Chinese companies. But it's an example of, you know, gaming the supply chain. So if you are a Chinese company that manufactures a consumer good, and you want to sell it on Amazon, you would think that at some point, you need to register as an American company, or register in some manner so that the government knows who you are, if only so that we can collect taxes for economic connected income. That's what they call it, ECI. No. Amazon will accept your Chinese registration.
I had no idea.
So literally, and it works with... Yeah, and it works with other countries too, but Chinese is just the prime example. So you can sell on Amazon and sell whatever thing you can knock off. So if Rick and Mark create a company, go on Shark Tank, come up with this great idea, someone in China knocks it off, there ain't shit I can do, because, you know, there's not even a company registration for that Chinese company. It's whack-a-mole and it's a pain in the ass. I've had it happen. It's happened a lot. But to the bigger point, so these companies in China are creating using FBA and all the Amazon features, right, without actually registering their company in the United States ever. And they're still, even though they're not registered, they're still supposed to pay taxes on the income that they create, because it's there's an economic connection. And I think it's form 11F1120. Right. Don't quote me on that. I've just been reading up on this. That's how I know it. It's not like I inherently know this stuff, but it was so insane to me. So insane. How many billions of dollars are in place? And then on top of that, but wait, there's more, right? You've got the same thing happening if you're selling on Alibaba, if you're selling on Temu and Shine and all that. And I'm sure it happens on other online platforms. I don't know how Walmart does it. But there's this thing called de minimis on tariffs, where if you ship goods in that's less than $800, and the Trump administration, to their credit, is trying to do that. Biden tried but didn't get it done. Trump, I know, is trying and hasn't gotten it done yet. If you're shipping something in and it's less than $800, you're not paying tariffs. And so not only you're not paying tariffs, you're not paying income tax on the billions, tens of billions of foreign goods sold off of Amazon. But wait, there's more. But wait, there's more, right? In the event that you are shipping to a Chinese company, let's just say I'm a Chinese company that sells toilet seats. I don't know, I'm just picking something out of left field. Right. And I have a subsidiary that truly is registered in the United States, and we compete against Mark and Rick's toilet seats. Well, I know there's a 25% tariff, and Mark and Rick buy my toilet seats. Right. You've been buying from me. Yep. You import them in. I sell them to you for $10 each. You pay your 25% tariff. OK, no big deal. But I have a Chinese company. There's a Chinese company that sells the same thing. I'm going to sell to my subsidiary company, not for $10, but let's just say for $6. Because when we go over and there's a tariff, you pay a 25% tariff on $6 instead of $10 to give another competitive and financial advantage over American companies. There are so many ways you can deal with this. And that's something that is critically important. And I've tried to raise a stink about it. And there's a lot of Amazon sellers that try to raise a stink about it. But if you really want to collect money from foreign companies that are selling over here,
that seems like the shortest path and the path of actual least resistance, because all it does is level the playing field in an actual way, not in the sort of like whack-a-mole chase the rabbit way of tariffs and then somebody else reciprocates and you're playing ping pong back and forth.
Donald Trump would be great at this, right? Going to these foreign countries and saying, look, you're ripping off all these American entrepreneurs. But one of the things that's unfortunate, and look, there's a lot I don't like about Trump, but you know, I'll give him credit where credit is due, and he can negotiate, he can create PR, and he'll do some smart things, but he would kill it going to China and these foreign countries and say, look, you're ripping off our American entrepreneurs. But the one thing is he doesn't talk about entrepreneurs. He only talks about the big companies, the $100 billion deals, the $500 billion deals. The truth, he doesn't, you know, it's unfortunate. He doesn't talk about, you know, the person in Idaho or Florida or Tennessee starting a toilet seat company in their basement.
Right.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
I mean, I think you and I both agree. I mean, this country needs to get its manufacturing base back.
Yes and no. Yes and no. Right. So we can talk about that if you want.
Okay. I'm curious. I mean, look, I think we have some strategic holes in our manufacturing base right now that are, to my mind, pretty dangerous for our economic health, for our security and everything else.
I agree with you across the board. The things we have to manufacture for the military and stuff like that. But those are going to be robotics driven, right? And that's the new infrastructure, robotics.
Right.
But
and it's like the lag time on buying generators or turbines or jet engines is now insane. 90 months for industrial size generators.
Yeah, it's insane.
That's crazy town. And it would seem to me there would be plenty of ways to tap that great American entrepreneurial drive and spirit. And yes, you combine AI, you combine robotics, you combine computer-aided machining, all those things rolling into, I mean, that's one of the great shames of this whole moment, I think. It's like the tariffs are on, they're off, they're on, they're off. If you have the shock of we got to do this ourselves in some of these places, America tends to do it itself once it gets sufficiently scared or pissed off or exasperated. But it's just like, I'm just curious, like as an entrepreneur, as a serial entrepreneur, I'm just curious, like where you think, like the market for companies doing big infrastructure, things like that, doing big, the complex manufacturing stuff that, you know, we've outsourced to China and Korea and Germany and other places for a long time. And it's not that we don't have the technical skills or the know-how. We know how to do this stuff. I mean, we just don't structure our thinking about it, I think, in the right way. But is it just short-termitis that's led us there?
Exactly, I'm just curious what your take on. And, you know, we have a trade surplus in services. And we have a global trade surplus in services because that's where the most margin is. That's where the most profitability is. And so if you're an American investor, even if you're an international investor and you're investing in the United States, you're going to go where the greatest returns are. And so that's why China has become so good at manufacturing, because they can be a low-cost provider. And they, you know, the investment return for the government and investors there, you know, they're employed people from the countryside that come up during the busy season, you know, and that's just not the same here. Now, and where you need to take that is we need to continue to invest in AI. We need to invest more in robotics. We've had some really good robotic software company, but to your point, you got to win the software layer first, the AI software layer first, because if you can't do that, then it doesn't matter what you can actually build, because you're not going to be able to build competitively. So you've got to win that layer first. And then the underneath the physical layer, the physical manufacturing, we've got to start winning robotics. We're not a leader in physical robotics. And so building the robots and selling the robots. Right now, that's Germany, Japan, and China. And so we've got to invest in that. I wrote a blog post years ago saying our new infrastructure shouldn't be about roads and bridges anymore. Fix those, but our new infrastructure where we really need to invest as a country is in robotics. You know, it's the old Dustin Hoffman plastics. Now it's robots. Yeah. You know, we're dating ourselves, but you know, now it's robots, because in order to make all these strategic things, they're all going to require robots and robotics. And so they may be cobots that work side by side by a person, but we need to make that investment in order to do these things.
It's also one of the things that takes people out of horrible, dangerous jobs in a lot of cases. I'd much rather have a robot, I don't know, digging coal or something than having a human down there or working in a steel mill.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we'll have nobody digging digging coal, right? but your point is well taken, right?
True.
There's dangerous jobs that robots, once they get the manual dexterity, there's military, and you know, you see what's happening in Ukraine with Russia, where it's about drones as much as it's anything else. Sure. And so being able to robotically manufacture drones that are more advanced, we have to win that. And being able to make products, like you can't make t-shirts yet with a robot. Do we really have to worry about making t-shirts, or can we give that to China as a low margin business and say, you take the t-shirts? But I agree with you, where we identify something that needs to be manufactured here that's strategic for any number of reasons, then yeah, we need to invest in it, but we can't pretend that we're bringing back the old traditional jobs. Where someone's just on a manufacturing floor and just screwing in screws. Those days are gone.
I've you know, counseled Democrats and Republicans over the years of my career about that. It's like, don't lie to people that we're gonna have guys welding shit all day long on an assembly line anymore.
Well, yeah, but
that's not the world anymore.
Like we have in Dallas on the Cost Plus Drugs, we manufacture sterile injectables. And we use all robots that we can change in, you know, 4 hours to a new drug. But we have 45 people that have to manage all that stuff and have to keep them up and running and have to monitor them. Now, we use AI to do a lot of that. But trust me, I get the emails, this breaks or that happens. And so, you know, and I'm not even opposed to having a conversation of taxing robots by the hour. You know, so, you know, it's just as a revenue source. You know, you don't want to create so much friction that it slows down development and our next industrial, if you will, revolution. But you know, a nickel an hour that a robot works across all the robots that, you know, the millions of robots, I think, you know, it's probably affordable and it contributes to, you know, tax revenues, which is a good thing.
Right. And I want to talk to you again about cost plus drugs, because I'm kind of fascinated by this as part of your entrepreneurial journey, because like I said in the beginning, you looked at like, what's a hard problem in healthcare? What's a problem? Everybody goes, oh, you can't fix that problem, but you are going at that problem. Talk to us about like how you decided to form Cost Plus Drugs and give people an idea of how it works and how it's
so
working.
It got started. I got into healthcare during Trump won because they were looking at overturning the ACA. And some people came to me and said, you know, this is something, you're an entrepreneur. You know, would you start looking at this? And I did, and didn't really come up with a great solution, but some things. And then, you know, as I was talking about those things, I got a cold email from a Dr. Alex Oshmyansky out of Denver, who was creating a compounding pharmacy to create drugs that were on short supply, that, you know, things like, there's a lot of pediatric cancer drugs, believe it or not, that go on short supply lists, you know, or Pitocin, sterile, all this stuff. And he's like, I want to build this endeavor. Would you invest? And I started asking him questions. And this was right around the time that the pharma bro was going to jail, maybe 2019, whatever it was. And I was like, you know, and I started asking Alex questions. I'm like, how can this dude take this generic drug, Daraprim, and jack up the price like that? And, you know, because basically he bought a year's supply from the one manufacturer and just ripped up the price. I'm like, you know, let me dig into this because there's got to be something more there. And then you start thinking about it. It's very simple. You get a prescription. And you and I are that age now. We got one, maybe two, right? And couple. And you go to the doctor and you say, Rick, Mark, you need this medication. What's the next thing they say? What pharmacy do you use? That's it. That is it. They don't say, how much does it cost? You have no idea what it costs. You have no idea. You know, if you get insurance from your employer, how much the employer is having to pay. Nobody knows or knew the cost of medications at all. And so I'm like, look, this is, you know, obviously an opaque industry. What if we brought some transparency to it? So we got the URL Cost Plus Drugs, and we set it up so that you go to costplusdrugs.com. You put in the name of the medication. We don't carry them all. We're getting there. We carry about 2,500, give or take. And you put in the name, and where we change the game, we'll show you our actual cost. So if metformin, tadalafil, imatinib, whatever it may be, you type it in there, type in the strength, whatever you need, the number of units you need, 30, 60, 90, however many, and we'll show you exactly what it cost us. Then we show you our markup, which is only 15%. And then we're primarily mail order. So if it's mail order, you pay $5 to have our mail order pharmacist review everything to make sure it's all hunky-dory, and then $5 to ship. And now we have an affiliate network, and so you can also pick it up at a local pharmacy. You just make those choices. So by just – we did two things. So just marking it up by showing our cost and marking it up 15%, our prices were dramatically, dramatically lower, particularly for high-end drugs that are used for cancer and stuff like that. And so, you know, there's drugs like imatinib, droxidopa, where, you know, if you just walk into a pharmacy today, they might charge you $2,000. And our price, depending on the strength, might be $13. I mean, it's just insane. And then we expanded it and we added our Cost Plus Drugs manufacturing, which, as I mentioned, is all robotics driven. And we make sterile injectables and biosimilars so that when there's a shortage for pediatric cancer drugs, we can make it so that those kids get the medications they need.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
And you know, markets, when people have information in markets,
I mean, the smartest thing that we did, Rick,
when they don't have information, that's fascinating. I mean, you really manufacturing brilliant. Figuring out the fact that people will be driven by good information, That I think is the is
oh, for
the
sure.
real secret sauce
right.
of this.
The thing it's, we didn't expect, the thing that innovation. We did that was the smartest thing. We actually published our entire price list of all 2,500 plus trucks. And where mm-hmm. that turned out to be far more impactful right. than I ever anticipated when I put it out there is all the researchers who hopefully still have jobs now, all the researchers are able to compare what CMS was paying for, you know, metformin or for imatinib. You know, we just got somebody from one of the agencies right. who's sent us a connection to the contract they were using for pharmaceuticals. And, you know, we're a third of the price. And, you know, so there's researchers are using us and coming out with reports saying, you know, if CMS bought these 9 urology drugs from Cost Plus Drugs, they'd save $900 million a year. If they bought these 12, oncology drugs, they'd save $2.3 billion a year. You know, just stuff like that, that, you know, now that that information was out there, everything started to change.
So pharma companies on the manufacturing side, they legitimately yeah. a lot of time put in a lot of research into these things. They invest on the front end. They deserve to be compensated for that kind of thing. But there are layers in here that you guys have identified basically yep. that aren't adding value to the chain. Like these benefit manager people are correct. Not adding value to the correct. Patient or the doctor or the cure. It's just yep. a cost layer in there. And that to me was like identifying a broken part of a system is as good as
100%,
building a,
right?
an effective
you're 100%
part of
right.
a system.
The challenge though is they're, you know, the big pharmacy benefit managers are some of the biggest companies in the world. You know, definitely some of the top biggest. So our biggest sure. challenge isn't with the manufacturers per se. What's happening is like the drugs we don't carry are typically mm-hmm. brand name drugs, the Eliquis of the world. And the reason we don't carry them is because sure. the big manufacturers for all the brand drugs are telling us that if we sell to you, or actually the way it works is they have these marketing rebate programs. If we give you a marketing rebate program, right, then the big PBMs are going to remove us or reduce our presence on their formularies, which means that they're going to lose billions, if not, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in revenue. So they're basically saying, Mark, we would wish we could work with you, but we can't. And that's our biggest challenge because we have really turned the world of PBMs upside down. So anybody out there who's a CEO of a company that has 25, 50, 100, 1,000, 5,000, 100,000, 500,000 lives that you're responsible for their benefits, you are getting ripped off on your pharmacy benefits and on your healthcare mm-hmm. benefits, which are as bad, if not worse, than the pharmacy side. And we're creating something called Cost Plus Wellness, where we're actually going to all the providers and hospitals, negotiating direct contracts, and then we'll publish those contracts so companies can copy what we're doing.
I was going to ask you, is there a follow-on act? Because the health, you've taken on a part of that vertical power structure of the healthcare system, but there's a lot more to it. There's
sure.
a sort of second
sure.
chapter to this.
It is so back-ass half-words on both sides, pharmacy and healthcare. But I'll give you the most fundamental example of how ridiculously stupid the healthcare side is. So you have an insurance plan, I presume, mm-hmm. that you have? Okay. So, and there's an insurance sure. company. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, they call them the BUCAs, the biggest insurance companies. Blue Cross Blue Shield, United Health, et cetera. Yep. And those companies create different plans for different markets. They'll create a set of plans for the ACA. They'll mm-hmm. create sets of plans for Medicare Advantage, for self-insured employers, for, you know, companies that get group plans. Yep. And in those plans, they'll set different variations. They'll say, here's our premium. And the higher the premium, the lower the deductible, right? And then ACA buyers right. will choose, you know, I'm younger, I want a higher deductible, lower premium. Your company will offer you choices. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm older, I want a lower premium. I mean, a higher premium, lower deductible because I might get sick, you know, but we all make our choices. Now, the crazy part is, you know, mm-hmm. who has to take the risk in the event a patient can't afford the deductible they chose in a plan they bought that an insurance company created? You know who takes all that risk in the event that that patient can't afford that deductible. It's not the government. It's the hospitals and the doctors. They become subprime lenders effectively. So when you hear all these stories about medical debt and how bad the hospitals are for trying to collect the medical debt, they don't set the deductibles. When there's a $5,000 deductible ACA plan, the insurance companies are like, thank you very much for taking this high deductible plan because, I'll get the premiums without fail, otherwise I'll cancel you. And the risk for the deductible is on the hospital when they go in there. And so now the hospitals become subprime lenders. They become the bad guys because they have to go collect money from all these patients. And the patients now have all this debt and going bankrupt, et cetera, et cetera. But what happens when they can't collect the debt? They have to raise prices for your healthcare to compensate for what they couldn't collect.
It's a ratchet. That ratchet keeps going, it's like this
vicious circle of pricing. And so the hospitals create these things called facility fees, which are its own ripoff and, site neutral pricing. And then the insurance companies complain. There's 10 other things that the insurance companies do that make it more expensive for patients. And so what we're trying to do with Cost Plus Wellness is just simplify it. Because the reason we can have an impact, healthcare is very simple. You go to the doctor. The doctor may or may not give you a prescription. The doctor may say you need to go for this care or that care. Yeah. And there's only two questions. How much are they going to charge you? And how are you going to pay for it? That's it. That is all of the uncertainty in healthcare. So what we're saying is, let's work on what's the charge, and let's work on helping people figure out how they're going to pay for it and make it transparent. Because if we can make it all transparent, then we might be able to follow the path that Canada went through in 1948, where one of their provinces said, look, we know in our province, the claims and the costs for everybody, and we think we can afford to pay for it ourselves and just charge premiums via taxes to all of our constituents, all of our citizens in that province. So we'll cover that. And that was the first universal health care in 1948 in Canada. And so for my companies, where we just started it this year, where we have direct contracts, there's no pre-authorization. So if an employee gets sick and goes to where we have a direct contract, in network, there's no pre-authorizations. We trust the doctor. We want them working as a doctor. There's no intercompany charge nonsense that the insurance companies pay. And there's no out-of-pocket deductible or out-of-pocket cost at all to our employee or their family. So in exchange for covering all those costs, we get a better price from the hospitals and the doctors because it's all cash up front. There's no receivables for them. Here's cash. So now I have a better feel because my costs are lower because I'm not cash constrained to do this. So effectively, I have single payer for the people who work for me for in-network claims. And once you have that transparency, you could grow it. Companies, on one hand, it's bad because we get our health insurance through companies. But if you had no out-of-pocket, it wouldn't be so bad, as long as the premiums were reasonable. And let's just say you're a city and you have 50,000 people and you have all your claims history and you can do an actuarial analysis of what your costs are going to be. And you say to people in your city, okay, we're going to charge you, we're going to charge a 2% tax, sales tax surcharge to pay for all the healthcare of everybody who lives in our town and pays taxes to ourselves. That is the path that we want to go. It's pure capitalism where companies and cities and states, and towns get to make their own decisions once they understand what the costs are. But if we can do it transparently, then you have a path to universal healthcare. The reason why we can't just convert to universal healthcare today is nobody knows what the damn prices are. The price of rent's too damn high and nobody knows what it is, right?
This is a fascinating conversation because it really does get down to that old conservative economic principle of the differential of information is what causes markets to be inefficient. And when everybody has the information, and there's no excuse now. You were just talking about they could do an actuarial analysis. Yes. AI is perfect for that kind of thing. We can trim this. We can get this stuff generated down to a way to target it, so you're not over or under.
Well, exactly right. And you don't service. You don't have the UK problem where, because it's all just handled by the federal government, or in Canada's place, the provinces, they limit, they look at the tax revenue they have, and then they limit what services they offer. You can have it, so you can create your own equilibriums, You can balance things out the way you want, and you know, but you put it in the hands, as long as it's transparent and everybody has that information, like you just said, then people know what's going on. And people know why decisions are being made the way they are, and they can make their own choices.
Well, Mark, I have to tell you, I am deeply impressed by you in a lot of ways. Your political candor, especially on Blue Sky lately, has been outstanding. I love it. You as an entrepreneur taking on one of the thorniest, weirdest, hard, like ugliest balls of yarn in healthcare stuff is just absolutely admirable in every way. And I am so grateful you came on the show today. I really appreciate your time.
Appreciate you, Rick. Yeah.
And I look forward to having you back in the future at some point.
Yeah, we need to talk politics. We really didn't get a chance to talk politics.
You know, we will do it again. Okay. We will absolutely dive in because you have an interesting position, I think, in the political ecosystem right now. And a lot of people are talking about you for the future, and we'll see.
Yeah, I'm not running for office. I'm not running for office, but I am going to try to push the AI the shit out of politics, because you know, the balance, we need that balance of all viewpoints and understanding how to 100%. Use AI to flood the zone so that, you know, everybody's got to respond is really important. Like, and you guys know it too. You guys do a lot of the same things.
Which we do our best. But thank you again, Mark. I really appreciate you coming on the show today. And I want to continue this conversation in the future.
You got it, Rick. Thanks for having me on. That was fun.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production.
Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe,
and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Produced by Whitney Hayes. Edited by Riley Main.
Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp.
If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.